many presentations made at the conference on June 18th titled 30 Years of ACT UP, Hidden Histories and Voices, Lessons Learned. For more excerpts, go to outfm.org, and for more on ACT UP New York, visit actupny.com. This is John Riley with Bob Lederer for OutFM and Health Action.
For WBAI in New York, I'm Linda Perry. Empire State Realty Trust, which owns the Empire State Building where WBAI's transmitter has been since 1965, has refused to negotiate with Pacifica in a lawsuit over our antenna lease. It filed a motion for summary judgment in New York State Supreme Court against WBAI Pacifica, the not-for-profit and non-commercial radio network. They claim WBAI owes them $2.1 million, increasing each month on our lease for the last 3 years. The onerous lease goes until 2020, with an additional obligation of $2 million more for the next 3 years of the lease. WBAI's operations and Pacifica's would be put in serious jeopardy if the judge grants the motion. The longer story, though, here involves the Empire State Building and its parent corporation taking advantage of the World Trade Center's antenna being destroyed in 9/11. This eliminated competition and left WBAI with no choice but to sign an unconscionable lease with large increases each year. The lease now says we should pay more than four times the present market rate of $12,000 a month. That's right. There's an attempt for your listener dollars to be swindled by our being charged four times the market rate. We're asking our state and local representatives to speak with Empire State Realty Trust to, one, resume negotiations with WBAI Pacifica to reach an equitable settlement in the lawsuit, two, to be reasonable and negotiate with us in good faith and release WBAI from the remainder of its lease with no penalty, and three, to waive the interest, late fees, and legal fees that have been accumulated in the last 3 years while we were only paying the market rate rather than what's in the lease. If you want to join the call to action and help listener-sponsored WBAI, please contact your local council members and representatives and senators and ask them to step in on behalf of WBAI. Many thanks. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Deviating slightly from our usual discussion of literary science fiction, fantasy, and the like, and following from last week's program with Terrence Taylor, we will have this week's program with Terrence Taylor, resuming that conversation. Stay tuned. Oh, yeah, and in case you didn't notice, we are broadcasting, not just webcasting. Hour of the Wolf movie review, air date June 29th, 2017. The Bad Batch. Take one. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. There are a few disturbing things about Anna Lily Amirpour's new dystopic near-future quasi-western, The Bad Batch. One comes near the beginning of the film when Suki Waterhouse, playing Arlen, a woman who for some reason winds up declared a quote-unquote bad batch by the U.S. government and is exiled to a kind of earthbound phantom zone south of the Texas border, gets captured by a group of cannibals and has her right arm and leg harvested. The sequence isn't particularly gory, but otherwise leaves little to the imagination. The second moment comes when Keanu Reeves, playing the drug lord who presides over the hedonistic community of Comfort, that's the name of the place, Comfort, espies the 7 or 8 year old girl whom Arlen took from the cannibals after killing her mother, and takes the kid into his Greco-Roman style palace, the implication being that the kid will eventually be indoctrinated into his corps of pregnant bodyguards. Again, the girl is 8 years old, still got a few years if that's the plan, but even then, ew, don't dwell on that thought too much. But the third thing is admittedly more personal. Throughout most of the film, I kept trying to think of the terms that would sum up Arlen's attitude to the events she finds herself enmeshed in. I kept coming up with phrases like, feather in the wind, leaf in the stream. So when Reeves's drug lord, toward the end of the film, likens her to a sailboat drifting on windless waters, that kind of threw me. You don't expect a film to go, no, no, here's the phrase you were thinking of. Which means it wasn't just me who was getting hung up on this aspect of the character. It's what Ms. Amirpour wanted. That's a problem, because it's not the easiest thing to take the part of a character who's kind of just drifting through the scenario. And it doesn't help when, in the latter half of the film, Arlen encounters the young girl's father, played by Jason Momoa, and starts falling in love with him. Keep in mind that this is one of the people who was chowing down on Arlen's steak at the beginning of the film. Also remember that Arlen killed the mother of this man's child, in an act of cold-blooded vengeance. So when he starts to reciprocate her feelings, that's just weird. Amirpour may be trying to say something about moral relativism here. And keep in mind that we're in a land of outcasts anyway, so these are people who largely have lived outside societal norms. But when these two people start making moony eyes at each other, I at least was thinking, okay, you guys got a lot of baggage to still get over before taking this to the next level. Amirpour does load the film with evocative imagery, stocking her cannibal enclave with chiseled bodybuilders and making Comfort a chaotic community of outcasts
with copious drugs and nightly raves. Giovanni Ribisi and Jim Carrey are in there, too. This is Mad Max, if the overall attitude wasn't so much hell yeah as, ooh, I don't know. The Bad Batch works to an extent. I would have liked a little more commitment. Philippine director Avid Leongarin has no trouble committing to his world. In his romantic comedy fantasy Saving Sally, which will be running at the New York Asian Film Festival in a few weeks, his main character Marty, played by Enzo Marcos, is a young comics artist who sees the world as if Michel Gondry had decided to take a more positive attitude toward life, stocked with whimsical technology from a bling-bedecked bus to a Fleischer-esque twisted telescope to a public park whose name is a pun on a Philippine singing star, and whose inhabitants oscillate between their human forms and animated cartoon monsters. That Marty sees the crush of his life, Sally, an inventor of even more whimsical machinery played by Rian Ramos, in hyperbolic, exalted terms, isn't that much of a surprise. That the scenario saddles him with being a go-between between Sally and her tool-like boyfriend, the film literally renders him in his monster form as a giant tool, if you get my meaning, is unfortunate, portraying Marty as a doormat and Sally as, at best, obliviously manipulative for too long. Nothing wrong with director Leongarin wishing to cast some shadows into the sunny little world of Saving Sally. It needs it, actually, to avoid whimsy overload. I just wanted to respect his characters as much as I admire his technique. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons, hashtag ITMFA.
Thank you, Dan. Sorry, everybody, I did not edit the opening of that. Or rather, I did edit the opening of that. And, well, it's been a day. It's been a very, very long day. So, Matt, you're on the air. So, we don't have much in the way of soundproofing here. So, as people are trying to deal with other business, like, I presume, what goes on at 5 a.m., we have to tell Lister. I think we know what it is. Nevertheless, we will do it. Terrence, are you there?
I should be.
Oh,
I?
Yes, you certainly are, and it sounds pretty decent for Skype.
Okay.
Skype to Skype is pretty decent. Skype to phone still really sucks. But, you know, it sounds like a phone call. But I have to admit, for lo these many years, I've always resisted doing phoners, shall we say. Aside from the fact that they are less personal, you don't have the person you can't give meaningful looks to or something like that. Aside from simply the in-room presence, the idea of talking to somebody on the air for 2 hours on the phone has always struck me as poor-sounding radio. But this isn't so bad.
No, I listened to it last week. It sounded quite good.
Yeah, there's a slight hollowness, but it's not too bad. So before we get into talking, continuing last week's discussion, which I had a lot of fun and we had a few points, both of us, each of us, all of us, I have to do a promo that, well, peripherally involves you, because I know that you're going to say you do it, but I make the announcement anyway. A week from tonight, today being Thursday in New York City, that is to say July 6th, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings begins its very first summer series. And it would normally were the first Tuesday of the month, but that would be on July 4th. And somehow I have a feeling July 4th might be a conflict for one or two people. So instead, we are the Thursday, and our readers will be, this has been booked so far in advance, which is to say, one of the two readers was booked about, 10 hours ago. Paul Witkover, a former curator of the reading series, in fact, directly preceded me. So I guess he was he was in there for either 2 or 3 years, I guess about 12 years ago. And he will be not only reading, but like Terrence did last year, he's going to choose his co-reader, who is Rosaline Maltese. And she's sort of wonderful. I don't know her as a writer. I do know her as a person. She used to work with Ellen Kushner. And both she and Paul worked together on Tramontane, one of the yet another one of them cereal box books. And this one is based on something that Ellen Kushner created, so it's not a surprise. So, that's the 6th. Thursday the 6th at 7 p.m. here at 388 Atlantic Avenue, ground floor. Admission is free, and we will make goo-goo eyes at you or whatever kind of eyes it takes in order to get donations, because it costs us to be here. So, Terrence, you were about to say you do it?
I was about to say what?
You were about to say to me, you do it?
Meaning,
well, I'm not hosting. I'm not hosting next week. Paul Witkover is. I'll introduce the event.
Oh, okay. Well, yes, then you can do it.
Yeah, I could. Or it could be one of your associates. And if you were there, It would be, of course, helpful. I still need help, I think, with the subtitles. The other stuff, I think, I sort of have okay.
Well, let's see who's available. The subtitles are fairly intuitive. If you can't figure them out, looking at the window.
If I can do the first one, I can do them all.
Yes, but it's you'll remember when you see where they are. It's fairly simple.
I think you're probably right. But I may ask for you to be available by phone. If not, show up. You'll enjoy it.
You never know.
And then
I might get a better offer. You never know.
Yeah, well, actually, if you get a better offer in this case, I would feel confident that you should take it.
There you go.
I don't feel unconfident. I will come in very early. I will make sure that everything is set up. Oh, and we have a new person. I have my own intern. Every summer, WBAI offers internships, and they are assigned to various producers. And the one who was assigned to me, usually they help out with social media, and I know how to do social media. But this one is heavily into science fiction and fantasy and wants to, quote, shadow me during the readings.
And
I told her, great, by all means. So we may actually have somebody, and she's very into horror. She's very into Lovecraft, old horror and new.
Okay.
Which is something that I'm weak in. You're strong on. But, you know, this could be a WBAI producer. Who knows? We'll see.
Time will tell.
Yeah, and August 1st is the second part of the summer reading series, and that will be Carlos Hernandez and Claire Cooney, C.S.E. Cooney. And anybody who attends, I warn you, if you're a diabetic, they really, 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 really like each other.
And they're so shy about expressing it.
Oh, God. I mean, holding hands during a reading, it was like Malka Older with her 2.5-year-old daughter.
That was being climbed while doing a reading.
Well, yes.
That child had an enormous reserves of energy.
I personally know that it was hell for you engineering on live stream, but I enjoyed her. I thought that she had such wonderful energy.
Yes.
You're dropping the word wonderful, I heard in your yes.
I'm
You're
I've learned social boundaries. I've learned sometimes it's best not to say anything. So.
It was very, very, very difficult on you as the engineer. But I thought that she brought a certain panache. Not that Malka herself and Daniel, older brother and sister, didn't. But it was sort of cool to see daughter and niece of them there in her debut performance. At any rate, good morning, Terrence.
Good morning.
So let's sort of recap a little bit what we were discussing last week and pick it up from there. Basically, we were... first, give your credits. We didn't do that at the beginning of the show last week. You are author of 2 published novels, great many short stories, critic at nightmaremagazine.com.
Indeed.
Actually, it's nightmare-magazine.com.
Ah, one must be specific in this world.
Well, if you're typing that in, there are 2 sister magazines. One is Nightmare Magazine and one is Lightspeed Magazine. And Lightspeed Magazine doesn't have a dash, but Nightmare Magazine does. So dash it all, or rather dash Nightmare. And good reviews, I must say. I am the audio editor of each and the podcast host of Lightspeed, but we're not even fellow travelers. I don't see Terrence's articles until they appear.
Indeed. I just turned in the second one.
Oh, very good. Actually, I could read it because I have rights to the folders in which they are stored up. But I'll read it on July 1st, so...
Oh, is that when the second issue comes out? I guess it does, yes.
Every issue comes out the first of the month.
Yes. So, once again, the clock has begun on the next review. I have one book, but I need another. I have to find a second companion novel to go with it.
Hmm. And you're doing, I assume, exclusively dark fantasy and horror?
Trying. That's basically the notion, it being what it is, being Nightmare Magazine.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to find new stuff. I mean, you start looking through the listings, and it's like, you know, if one more person inherits a house in the small town they grew up in and left years ago under a dark cloud, I'm going to puke. You know, it's like, just try something else, you know. So the things I've been finding so far are sort of odd, off the beat sort of thing. So that's been sort of the fun of it.
Does anybody review short fiction?
The current review, actually, I review an anthology. So, to that degree, not short fiction like a short story. I've not seen that done, though. I imagine there's a market for that. Someone could probably do a decent column of some kind reviewing short fiction.
Yeah, I mean, there is Tangent, which, you know, well, in my opinion, has lost its luster. And there's also a website, which coincidentally is run by, I believe, the copy editor of both Lightspeed and Nightmare, which reviews a story a day.
Okay.
Which I think is a very nice idea. But anyhow, so you've written 2 novels that are vampiric in nature and have the third novel, which you read...
In front of me, actually. I was working on it even as you called.
You read a portion of it on the show last week.
Indeed. I was also over at Danielle's this afternoon with... Sam and Havala, we were all writing on her terrace, which has an exceptional view. It's quite nice.
I haven't been there yet.
Yeah, but it's like, well, she's trying to sort of rig it up for like socializing. So we were looking at projector possibilities.
That would be good on the terrace because I'm allergic to cats.
Yeah, well, that was actually, I didn't realize we'd be on the terrace. I actually popped, which oddly enough didn't knock me out at any given point today, which is odd. But I had popped an antihistamine in anticipation. Evidently, the cat liked me because it took one look at me and then rolled over and lounged on the floor in a manner that she says indicates that it is accepting you and trusting of you and that you are okay by the cat. So it was like, oh, well, thank you, cat. So I
love cats. I used to have four, and that's how I discovered I was allergic, by having four of them.
Well, that you're lucky you're still alive. I mean, basically, when I got a second cat, I stopped being able to breathe and had to, unfortunately, send them both off. Fortunately, to live with Linda's mother. It had better have been Linda's mother, because I had a dog sent to the farm, and I didn't find out what that meant until Friends did an episode, and that was sort of. What do you mean? I'm sure there are a lot of people in the same situation that night. But yes, but I mean, I like cats, but I have to scrub my hands after petting them. They immediately, when they see me, gravitate to me immediately.
The dander flies through the air. It's carried on their hair. People think that they're allergic to fur. They're not.
No. It's the dander. To the dander. Evidently, there are less dandery cats that you can get. I also hate mice, and we are having a battle with them in the building. I haven't seen any in a while, a cat would get rid of them.
A mutual friend of ours, Randy Dawn, has a hypoallergenic pooch.
I'm not as allergic to dogs. They showed up in the test, but I don't respond to dogs in the same way that I do to cats. Cats are immediate and vicious in terms of the intensity of the allergies, but dogs I've not really, though technically in the testing that was on the list,
dogs. But this one, who I know you've met, this pooch is hypoallergenic.
I do not believe I have met this dog. Did you say I've met this dog? I've not met this
Randy's
dog.
Randy's dog?
I know Randy, but I've not met Randy's dog.
Oh, well, ask Randy sometime to meet her pooch. It's like too adorable for words.
Well, most are. I like dogs.
Anyway.
I've become more of a dog person as I've over the years. I sort of hit a point, I guess, when I was like distant and somewhat aloof, I preferred a pet that was the same. But as I became more of a social creature, I've grown more dog-like, I suppose, in my devotion.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a dog downstairs. The best position in the world is to have a dog in the building. I can walk him anytime I want, much to the gratitude of my neighbors, and it's very therapeutic. There's a little dog run nearby. I take the dog there. You feel a little weird when you go to the dog run with someone else's dog. It's like going to the park with someone else's kid, because at some point in the conversation, you have to admit it's not actually your dog. And it's like, which gets weirder, I guess, if you have to actually admit it's not your kid. That would be much stranger. But it's sort of funny because I always feel compelled to sort of at some point say, but I am not actually the owner of this beast. I am merely the uncle. I am the upstairs neighbor who works at home and can walk him and take him out when his owners, you know, suddenly are stuck at school and can't come visit. Come let him out. And, you know, he's great, because it's like I don't have the responsibility. I don't have the daily responsibility. But taking it on periodically, perfectly acceptable, helps them out tremendously. Very therapeutic. Dogs are very therapeutic.
Yeah.
I don't feel quite the same way about cats. I can't go walk a cat and feel better that day.
But no, but they
somehow can. You walk with a dog, you discover a world you never knew before.
Yeah, but cats can be they have loads of personality.
Well, yes, it's mostly one that's shared among them consistently, but it's not.
I had four cats; they were all very distinct.
People like to say that. And they are in their own little ways, you know, as all dogs are. I mean, dogs are fairly uniform in there, but yet are distinct as well. So I mean, there's a kind of basic template, and then there's unique modifications each one brings to it. My Siamese was utterly insane in a way that pretty much most Siamese are. But I always liked Siamese somehow. We grew up with them, sneezing, as it turns out. That was the reason. We didn't know that then, because no one cared if children sneezed. No one tried to find out why. They just told them to stop. and to go blow their nose.
And how did that work out for you?
It was like mostly me growing up with people saying, stop sniffing, blow your nose, and me growing up to realize that these bastards made me mow lawns and live with two cats. And I was allergic to both. Why? Why did they make me? Why?
So anyway, we should get to
a point our that topic. Someone might want to listen to instead of our idle banter.
Yes.
Well, you know, we were discussing adaptations from the literary to TV series and films, or are we just doing TV series?
We can include films to an extent, but what I am really very much taken by at this point is the new form, the new, I don't know what to call it, long short form of television in which you take stories, whether they are based on books or not. Some are original, some are based on books. Some, when they are based on books, cling to the book's plots very closely, but then wander a good deal. Like, case in point, American Gods, which I've seen the first 7 out of 8 episodes of, and I'm very annoyed that it's not more episodes. And Handmaid's Tale, which is what I'll be watching after American Gods. Or, for example, the 2 seasons that have existed so far of The Man in the High Castle. And Ridley Scott is a good case in point. Mm-hmm. Because he already made a film called Blade Runner that some people have heard of. And Blade Runner has very, outside of the names of certain characters, and the concept of replicant has very, very little to do with the novel Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick. Whereas The Man in the High, and the premise of Blade Runner and Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, in Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, the world is very under-inhabited. People have been dying off. That's why they need replicants to go out and do mining in the colonies. And it's very important status for people to own automata animals. And so one of the 2 lead characters of the novel is a toy maker who can make autonoma, and the other one is the Blade Runner, who retires them when 6 of a particular type go rogue. But the most important aspect of the novel is it is primarily about religion. It is primarily about, I forget the name of the guy, the sort of Sisyphus kind of character. On every street corner you go to, you can put your hands into a box and feel empathy for this guy who is trying to roll a rock up a hill and never succeeds. And it is up to you, Mercer his name is, and the religion is Mercerism. And each character, each person, has to put their hands in the box in order to empathize with that character. Now, this is one of the most essential Philip K. Dick points of that novel. Now, none of that describes the movie. Only a very slender part about Rick Deckard trying to retire Roy Batty. A very small part of the novel. Whereas the TV series, The Man in the High Castle, has, first of all, a lot of the characters. I was going to make another point about the movie Blade Runner. In Blade Runner, L.A. and the world are overcrowded, which is antithetical to the very premise of the novel. In The Man in the High Castle, produced by Ridley Scott, but created by other people obviously working for him, the world, the universe of The Man in the High Castle is exactly identical to Philip K. Dick. But what we're seeing are storylines that are set in the East Coast, which we never see in the book, and some storylines in the West Coast, which are very much there. And instead of a book that is a book of revolution showing the real world, as it were, it's a series of videos. It has totally taken almost, it really, really, really has the spirit of Philip K. Dick, even though it has none of the story and none of the characters virtually. And yet you watch it and you go, yeah, that's it. That's right. And I feel similarly about American Gods, that I've now seen 7 out of 8 episodes, and I really wish that there were 13 episodes. And here's part of the problem. With American Gods, only 2 of the 5 episodes have anything to do with the novel. And yet, they all feel very genuine. They all feel very Neil Gaiman, who's the author of the book. How much Neil has to do with American Gods, I don't know. I know when I had Lev Grossman on this program about 1.5 years ago and spoke to him about the TV series The Magician, The Magicians, based on his trilogy, and his name is on there as executive producer, I said, just how involved are you? He said, oh, hey, he sent me an email about once a month.
Yeah, as long as the check's clear. Well, you know, regardless of Gaiman's involvement, the series invariably gains a life of its own. I mean, it's the purpose is different. I mean, the purpose of a novel is to tell a story that's contained within a unit. The purpose of a series is to perpetuate itself infinitely. And the duality of television, the comedy, the joke has been for years that everything resets to what it was, that by the end everything's back in the original balance, so that the next week the same stupid thing's going to happen again and again, but no one ever advances, no one changes. That's changed somewhat in comedy.
I mean, that was true in Star Trek up through Enterprise anyway. My understanding is the new Star Trek that will be coming out is in fact an ongoing arc, one big story.
Yeah, well, you know, which is all very well and good and nice. And that's, you know, part of the modification of things. But that's the thing, is whether you do arcs or individual, all the things we're talking about so far are arc series, and that it's a continuing narrative over the seasons, as opposed to, like, individual episodes that, you know, are one-offs. So it becomes very interesting because, of course, you know, it's interesting because the problem is, and this is branching out of adaptations, but like taking a series like the 4400, which the first season was brilliant. It was fascinating. All these people that have been vanishing, suddenly you're coming back. Where are they coming from? Were they abducted by aliens? Were they taken by time travelers? And the whole first season is engaged in trying to answer that mystery. The problem was that the original concept was to do something that would reach over time, but they were only given a contract for a single season, which meant they compressed their original concept down to a season, and then when it did well and it was expanded, they were suddenly left without any material left, in essence. So the second season was essentially the undoing of everything that was described as happening in the first season, and then trying to build a whole new conspiracy. And essentially the series just sort of, I think, just kind of collapsed under the inertia of all of this unraveling and re-raveling, and it lost whatever validity it may have had at the beginning, where you were like drawn into a story. At the point you're being told that none of that is really it, and now we're going to mystify you again, and look this way, you know, it just sort of lost it. So it can work against you. The problem, I haven't read American Gods yet. The problem I was having with the series was that, yeah, that opening is always sort of intriguing, but okay, yes, I guess we're now going to get the origin story of every single deity that ever got to the Americas.
Which is not, by the way, in the books at all.
I'm sure not. But there's a lot, I'm sure, that's not in the books, that are stylistic choices made because of the medium. I mean,
I have to say that I enjoy those. I enjoy the origin stories of how each deity came over. Although episode 7, the entire episode pretty much is about one single deity that isn't even really much in the book at all.
Well, you know, the Queen of Sheba evidently was one scene in one chapter, and now she's like being, because the thing is, you get things, what you get is the phenomenon of media. I mean, ironically, media is an actual character in this series, but the allure of media, the worship of it, applies to the show as well. It's like there are elements in the show reading the producers where it's like, oh my God, once we saw so-and-so, we decided we had to do this whole background story on the Irish woman who is with the leprechaun because the actress can do great accents and she's amazing and she could do the character. So they start branching into storylines just to show off aspects of different elements that they've got in play.
Yeah, and that was brilliant. I watched that just a few hours ago.
It was quite fun, you know, but it also gets very...
But by the way, let me just say that the book is extremely episodic and that many of those stories that are separated in the series called Coming to America, most of those are in the book. They're simply, you know, breaks in between episodes and they're told in italics and they don't really necessarily relate to the novel at all.
It sounds like they fit into the novel the same way they fit into the series, which is background material that is introductory in between larger chunks of greater story.
Actually, they fit into the series better than they fit into the novel.
Yeah, but I think it's a similar interjection.
Yes.
I think what becomes interesting to me is what I'm seeing in American Gods is what I saw in Legion, which I've seen in both these series more than others. Possibly it was in Fargo. I've not seen the earlier seasons. Oh, excuse me, a little indigestion there.
The last episode of Fargo was like a mind bleep.
Well, I have to watch the whole series in general, so I have to go back now Legion. I'm very curious.
Understand that each season. I understand. Totally
we've had that conversation.
Crossovers.
I don't want to lose my point of thread.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Chain of thought, because you know how easy it is for me to lose it at this hour. One of the things that I find interesting about American Gods, as well as Legion, which I saw illustrated first in Legion, is that they're being done with a remarkable grasp of the medium and the ability of film, I will call it film, as cinema versus film as a physical medium, film as a conceptual medium, film as opposed to movie, as opposed to anything else. But both those series to me are illustrating many aspects of pure cinema in terms of storytelling, using all the aspects of cinema, sound, image, time, distortion of time, manipulation of plastic space so that images become other than what they actually are, all of the misdirection of things, the use of illusion, the fact that you can make a woman look convincingly dead and mobile, you know, but they're all also within individual episodes start playing with the medium and the form of the medium to tell those individual episodic stories, which is what I find interesting. So that there are stylistic variances between episodes. There are more in Legion, which got really into different genre making almost between episodes. But even in American Gods, where there are different aspects of the story have different styles in the way they're done. The introductory pieces about the origin stories of the gods are very stylized, very poetic, each
one
very differently
animated.
Yes, and took 6 months of it. I'm like, good God, how do you even plan that
in the
course of a production? Yeah, I read about that. But beautifully done. So it's all very fascinating. The only issue I have, there are two issues I have, and they're really the same issue, which is in watching it, yes, it's like 8 episodes. We have barely begun to scratch the surface of the story. Regardless of the relationship to the novel, we have only gotten to the first volley in the war between the gods, which we've been talking about infinitely. And I understand that if you're dealing with this as a landscape of story that can stroll through 8 years the way Supernatural has and do arcs that go 12, 20 episodes long, because we can do that. you know, and we can wrap that one up and then thread in the next storyline that begins. So it's fascinating, but I felt myself getting a little impatient at times with the leisurely pace of the progression. When you do get, when you get to the episode where we're getting Shadow and his wife's background, and we're getting the plan, the meeting, her life, his life, the plan gone wrong, all of these different things. But at the same time, and you have not seen 8 yet, but not to give anything away, by the end of the last episode of the season, all of those digressions actually were for a purpose. And it's because there's a revelation in the last episode that makes it very important to know all of those things. Mm-hmm. So it was a very odd thing in that while it was going on, I felt myself withdrawing to a certain degree, going, oh, God, just get on with it. And can't we just get further into the story? And at the same time, at the end, sort of seeing why it was structured the way it was and going, I'll give you another season. You can, we'll see where you go. You don't need to do that again. Maybe the pace will pick up. The other thing is that we do have a vast panoply of deities on both sides. And as a result, we get precious little of some that are quite remarkable. I mean, Anansi, I freaking loved when he was introduced. And it took 4 more episodes to get any more of him playing that character. And it there are gods, Vulcan, we actually, spoiler, kill off. We see him in one episode. Some deities we see in one episode. We've got another one who should be coming back soon because you're supposed to meet them at the battleground, which we seem to have arrived at by now. So next season, I'm sure, will be much more active because it's the actual war. But I do find the usage. Marvel did a similar storyline with the Hercules character, where Hercules at a certain point is battling modern deities who represent different aspects of the modern world.
Let's explain to listeners the difference between the old gods and the new gods.
Well, in terms of American gods, the idea in both storylines. Because this is, I think, what happens in my mind, at least, is that the genre writing is the myth-making of the modern age. Science fiction, fantasy, horror. These are the stories that we once told around campfires. They're the stories about the great gods. Now the great gods are superheroes. Now the great gods are celebrities. Our deities are different. The process is the same. We tell the stories about them, and in the stories about them, we learn more about ourselves, which is why superheroes have such human failings, as did the Greek and Roman gods, the Norse gods, and the gods of everyone but Christianity. Christianity was the only god without, and possibly Buddhism, but even Buddha had his issues along the way. So at any rate, looking at these things is something that reflects the zeitgeist, the modern age, what we're looking at. We are in the 21st century. We are seeing images once again because NASA's got a new raft of pictures from Mars and different places and the sun and all these things. We're getting a bigger, vaster sense of our scale in the universe and things like that. It's harder for the old gods to retain the fan base they once had, which is the basis of American Gods and the basis of the Hercules storyline, where the Greek gods and that are and all the other old gods, the Norse gods as well, are all battling for validity in the modern age. And as we look around, it's perfectly natural to go, well, there is a need to worship images or sources of power that we can importune to our benefit. Whether it's like, you know, one of the Cardassians buying our clothing line and raising us up to their stature or making us a cast member of the reality show, the odds, how the gods bless us has changed. But we still have gods. The thing is that the gods are different. So American Gods does a very nice job of representing them. And there's a god called tech. There's a god called media. There's Mr. World, and I'm not quite sure yet, except for being the father of the gods. And
by the way, yeah, Crispin Glover, is he wonderful in that role or what?
You know, Crispin Glover is one of the stranger little actors of the world because he doesn't do a lot.
He has a real reputation.
He has a very interesting reputation about what he does in his spare time. He's almost like the Kubrick of actors in that he can do one role every 10 years, retain a reputation even without being present. And when he pops back in something like this, I hadn't read the cast list. I really went into American Gods knowing as little as possible so that as people appeared, it was like, oh, my God. And it became clear after a few episodes that we're just going to see some great faces. We've got a lot of actors that are going to be familiar actors who we enjoy in genre.
And a lot of people that have been in past Brian Fuller TV series.
Yes, that are going to be in this. So it was interesting. We were just on a point, and I've lost the thread for the
about
first
the
time
gods,
tonight.
About
the ancient and the new gods. Well, anyway, getting back to that thought, we need to worship. We need to put that energy somewhere. We do worship technology every time we sit there and stare at a screen at a table with somebody else at it. We're worshiping our gods. We're not. Mm-hmm. Paying attention to somebody in the room. Everyone is there in prayer, in a weird way. Heads are bowed. Faces are illuminated as if by candlelight. I mean, the analogies can be laid out very easily. And more importantly, we give the energy to these practices that we once gave to prayer. The devotion that we gave to the rosary, we now give to Twitter. And it's that same focused attention of ritualistically flipping through Facebook entry after Facebook entry is thumbing of the beads, and each one is its own individual prayer. I mean, I could go on for days with this cheesy analogy, but you get the point. The energy makes it natural. We would wonder, well, where if we don't believe in the old gods, what do we believe in now? And we know what we believe in. We believe in reality TV stars. We believe in social media. We believe in what we're told by social media because that's what our presidency became. It became someone who was something that we were told by social media. And the number of people it took to convince was just enough to tip that over and make that reality. So there's a fascinating...
And he was a so-called reality show TV star.
Yes, and a large part of the pantheon of the new gods. I mean, Trump is a new god. I mean, like it or not.
He absolutely
and
is.
The problem is that he's a trickster god, and that's mm-hmm. what we forget is that power doesn't necessarily mean benign. I mean, you can be powerful and be Loki. You can be powerful and be Anansi. You can be powerful.
We haven't seen a whole lot of Loki, have we?
Interest at heart.
We saw Loki in the first episode, and I don't think we've yet seen him since the first episode.
I don't even remember him in the first episode.
He's in the jailhouse now. He is the cellmate. He's Shadow's cellmate.
Oh, interesting. I'll have to go back and look at that.
His name is. That he was known for boosting things, and he did it in a low key.
I'll have to go back and look at that.
It's a bit obvious.
Well,
we don't see him again.
Well, as I say, well, the thing is, there's a lot seated in that we see again. Sheba has had maybe three appearances. She has, lived up to her premiere,
She'll be in there more. I just find it interesting that the first two episodes clung to the book in such a brilliant literary basis that you went, oh my God, they've done it. They've really done it. And then they started expanding into other areas that are off book in the little bits that they show after the episodes where you get Brian Fuller and the other producer talking about it. They talk about, well, now we're off book. And I thought that's exactly the right word. They are now off book. But you know what? The book that they have rewritten is so perfect. And that's why I really wonder, and actually I'll be talking to somebody, and we're going to have somebody at the Nirsif readings that is so close to Neil Gaiman. That we can easily ask and find out. That would be Elisa Quitney, by the way.
Okay. But yeah, this is, I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, the thing is, it's what is intriguing is, I think, for the producers more than, and hopefully ultimately for the audience,
is the
exploration of the adaptation of a story from one medium to another, which has different requirements of time, of attention. What is interesting about
American... used to suck so much because you always used to have to compress, and now they're actually expanding from the original and doing a good job at it in several different shows.
Well, because the thing is, there are so many more playing fields. I mean, when you've got Netflix and you've got Hulu doing Handmaid's Tale, when you've got all these venues that are suddenly investing in original programming and basically saying, give us something that we can keep going if people like it. But
Why didn't older media do this? Why wasn't this possible on ABC?
Because there was a different model of media at that point. And the thing is, well, partly I think because of the realities of the expensive commercial television. I think that their business model is different. I think the way they pay out and buy things and make things happen is different. But they also...
They're all going to the upfronts. They're all competing at Sundance together. They're all and the old media people, if you will, are like shocked to look over and go, oh my God, there's somebody from Amazon.
Well, but this is why everyone's fighting to get rid of net neutrality, because anyone can do that.
Yeah.
I mean, essentially, there was a series I told the story about sitting in my barber shop one day while they were going on and on about this web series called Sex and Violence. The production values are terrible. I mean, but the second season, they got a good opening together that looked like The Sopranos opening because they got enough money together to cut a good opening. And they started improving because after they got a lot of followers, they started getting money and donations so they could afford to hire better actors. And the funniest thing I heard that day with the everyone talking about it was that they'd started killing off characters from the first season who were the worst actors. Basically, anyone who could not act was being killed off at the storyline and being replaced with new characters that were played by better actors who were being paid more. So it slowly over time is evolving into a well-produced good show with a street sense and base. But the reality is that the guy could do it because of net neutrality, because anybody can put up a high D show on Vimeo or YouTube and get an audience and make millions of followers and be able to do that because they are in the same line as ABC and Hulu and Netflix and all these other providers. Now, what's interesting is that there were long-term series that were – I mean, I cited Peyton Place last week.
Yes.
Peyton Place was a soap opera based on a novel that had a big reputation. It ran for years on television. The exact same concept.
It did not have radio, did it?
I don't remember.
It may have been on radio.
I don't remember.
There were a lot of major soaps on radio, but I don't think Peyton Place was one of them.
But Peyton Place was specifically adapted from a book. And the thing is, it had to have gone off book rapidly because the thing was on TV for years.
Yeah.
That led to a lot of other late night soaps. I mean, you had the Dynasties. You had Dallas. You had these epic stories that took place over a vast period. What you didn't have, and they were continuous storylines. They were soaps in that the storyline was continuous. They weren't episodic. Each episode had a cliffhanger, but the storyline was continuous. What you didn't have was that in genre fiction. Star Trek was not like that. Star Trek was individual episodes. It was on a short story serial base. You know, it was like you get individual stories, but sci-fi did not do
the late night,
Outer Limits, Twilight Zone, the classic things, they were all episodics. I'm trying to think of when Battlestar Galactica really kind of was one of the early arc series because it was, we were going to look for Earth, you know, and then we find out a whole thing. But they had...
And there you're actually talking about the horrible original with Lorne Greene.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, okay.
But despite the fact that I hated it and Babylon 5, I have to say that it did have an overreaching arc. The series began with a destination in mind, and the course of the series was getting there, and they ultimately did. So that was the beginning of something. I'm trying to think of other early ones, but that was an original thing. Obviously Game of Thrones is like the latest most successful series based on a literary thing that's diverged from the literary roots.
Well, it had to because the TV series has outpaced the writing of the books.
Yes. Which is another reason they had to invent their own storylines and keep it going, because the books weren't getting out there fast enough.
Yeah, but and there was this thing where there was at a Comic-Con, there's a clip on YouTube where all the fans are going after George Martin, saying, "You've got to write book 7 now. How are we going to do the TV series with that? And HBO wants this," and so on and so forth. And by no small coincidence, it was Neil Gaiman who took the microphone from George. They are good friends. And he said, "Folks, let me tell you something. George R.R. Martin is not HBO's bitch."
I saw the clip, yes.
It's a nasty turn of phrase, but you get his point, you know? It's simply like George is now doing anthologies, he's doing new wild card books, he's writing other things, and you know what? He's doing what he wants to do, and oh, by the way, he's got the money to do it. So,
well, ultimately, you know, that's the price of success, is that your favorite author may stop writing the thing that made him your favorite author because he now has the money to do anything he wants. And he didn't want to do that.
Anyway, they're doing four spinoff series.
But the bottom line is, it doesn't really matter anymore because of that. I mean, the people who are satisfied by this series could give a damn about the books, really. I mean, the books could exist or not exist. The show is now its own self-generating thing.
Well,
but I think that's where it has to go.
Now, how do you feel about Legion? Now, I'm like the opposite on American Gods. I know the book extremely well, you not at all, but you're watching American Gods with great interest. I, on the other hand, all apologies to our friend Chris Claremont, I was not familiar with Legion in any way, shape, or form. You are extremely familiar with it, but I watched it with great joy and interest. How would you compare what Chris Claremont hath wrought with Legion to Noah Hawley's TV series?
Well, it's a completely different approach, because Legion is not based on any single storyline in Marvel. It's essentially Legion as a character has spread across a great number of things in Marvel. He had his own comic series for a while where he was more of a heroic character who had his multiples in line. The character in the comics, if I may speak of such things, is described as a multiple personality. He is the most powerful mutant on the planet because he's telepathic, psychokinetic. But in actuality, in the comic books, he has at all seemingly thousands of abilities, each of which manifests in an individual personality. And at a certain point in the comic series, there are like struggles to dominate the body. And so like in one storyline I just ran across and finally tracked down, trying to find out stuff about the Shadow King, you know, whichever of the characters inside his head grabs a doll, takes over the body and manifests its power through the body, whether it's flame or telekinesis or whatever.
Yeah, but
so
you see, I don't even recall there. They show the character. I don't recall even calling him the Shadow King.
Let me finish addressing that.
Yeah.
In the TV series, they address him as schizophrenic. There are various flash shots of him being assaulted by a crowd of people who could be representative of the Alters. They have not explored this terrain aspect of David in the comic books yet. To not go into the whole history of all the details of what is in the comics, I don't need to do that. The bottom line is that Claremont created a character with whoever drew it originally that then was expanded by other writers as well throughout many permutations of comics, including comic books where the character was on his own. And he goes from being a passive victim at times to a highly aggressive, almost villainous character to being simply a being of power that is manipulated by various forces. What the TV series did beautifully was it was sort of like the producers said, okay, I have read all of these things. I am now going to construct an individual narrative based on what I know about that character, using that which I desire to use to tell this particular story. So what he's essentially managed to do in the first season is to launch the concept of this character and a wide-ranging view of the degree of power he possesses, which we've seen manifest in various ways throughout the first season, without necessarily giving away the ranch, without giving you everything he's potentially capable of. There are allusions that there is more to come. The question of whether David is schizophrenic or simply had powers and was told he was crazy because he saw things or did things other people couldn't is still in question in the series. Because
yes.
You don't know yet. And that's been the fun thing. So, but it's a very different thing from American Gods, where you've got a specific narrow-focused narrative in a novel, and you're adapting that storyline and then expanding beyond and taking a character who's depicted in hundreds of issues and honing down to that portion of what you wish to do, and then creating an individual story. The way that story plays out isn't in the comics at all.
They're being very, very, very coy in the TV series, although they mention it. I noticed it specifically in episode 7 about who is our lead character. And I don't mean Mr. Wednesday. I mean Shadow Moon.
Well, I won't give away anything in the 8th episode necessarily, but obviously Shadow's far more than he appears to be.
Yes.
And by the 7th episode even, you should have seen this. We're talking spoiler stuff here.
Yeah, yeah.
But the fact that Shadow was manipulated to the degree he was to put him where he is because of his importance in the overall storyline as a character of hidden strengths that have yet to be revealed.
Which
so
is
that'll
an
be
interesting thing, because in the novel, we really don't find any of that out until the end of the novel. And we're only about a quarter of the way through the novel by episode 8.
Yeah, but we're still just hinting. I mean, all we've yes. said is, Chosen One, what? Did I say Chosen One? It's like, Chosen One. You know, it's like they're sort of, I don't know. They're pointing in that direction. Obviously, it's going to have impact by the end. But the basic reality is, though, the American Gods as a series is open-ended until it loses an audience, in which case it just dies on the vine, Firefly, and we never get to see the end until they do the reunion movie,
yeah.
and then we get to see it wrapped up.
Well,
the bottom line is that whatever his significance is in the book and whatever that revelation is, that can be done at the end of the War of the Gods storyline ending, which can be wrapped up. And then whoever's left are launched into an additional secondary storyline that then leads them off into a new series.
That there is, there's at least one, I think maybe two, but I know of one brilliant novella that is just about Shadow Moon that doesn't involve any of the other characters that we have seen in American Gods. It's just a Shadow Moon short story or novella, and it's brilliant. And there is also a novel of the Anansi Boys, which is
which I read. Well, the thing
now it's interesting that you read that after
I didn't know without the having read them.
They really do exist very separately. And I have to say, by the way, that in terms of tone and quality, I enjoyed the Anansi Boys, but I didn't think it was anywhere near as good as American Gods.
Yeah. Well, the point I was going to make was basically that there is a large, obviously, body of work around American Gods and characters that he splashed off into separate pieces. And the reality is that the show can take it or leave it. I mean, they may draw inspiration from some of the storylines. They may just go off in another direction entirely. I mean, that's the thing that they – I mean, bottom line, you've got a couple of kids having enormous fun with a big toy. They may not really care what daddy did and what he left in the closet in the box for them. They may just take it where they want to go with it and not even look at that.
In this case, I'm not sure about – I think that Brian Fuller, as a producer, does care.
Yeah, well, I'm not saying he doesn't care, but I'm just saying that there's the freedom of both. And the thing is, it's like it just – it'll be whatever it is. Ultimately, mm-hmm. it gets very zen. I mean, they have the freedom to take it or leave it. The advantage with a product like that, with something that does have a vast literary market to it – I mean, anybody who ever did a TV series of any kind about Discworld would just have – infinite storylines they could fall back on forever, but they could also do their own stuff. And that's the thing. You've got a big body of work. You can go back to it, and it gives you a lot of good on-target stuff that people enjoy that you could even just take the seed from. But other than that, you also have the freedom to invent a whole new range of stories
Did three TV movies of Discworld, each one 2 hours long. And the first two, I thought, were splendid and wonderful and really dealt with the novels almost perfectly. And then the third one, Going Postal, started good, and then I'm afraid it sort of fell down in the last hour.
I still pretty much enjoyed it. It was fun. I like the guy from Coupling, so he was fun to see.
Yes.
Well, you know, it's but
and Claire Foy. Let us not forget Claire Foy, who's likely to be winning an Emmy shortly.
Who's gotten some mild success since then, hasn't she?
Yes, she has.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I'm curious.
Not to mention in the second Discworld TV show, Hogfather. Mm-hmm. Now I'm blanking on her name, Michelle.
Well, that's actually what I'm thinking of, not Claire Foy. I'm thinking of her because she's in Downton playing Miss whatever.
Yeah, Downton Abbey, but the lead female who is of Going Postal plays Queen Elizabeth in The Crown.
Oh, yes.
And she is a very, very strong contender for the Emmy for Best Actress, as is WBAI's former drama and literature director, or at least member of drama and literature department, John Lithgow, who plays Winston Churchill.
Busy people. Busy people.
Oh, yes, very much so. But she was unknown when both of them were unknown when they did the Discworld things. It'll be very interesting to see where Discworld goes from here. It's in the hands of Pratchett's daughter, and she has very, very specific instructions from him.
Yes, then he'll haunt her if she doesn't follow them.
Oh, yes.
I have to run and grab something. I'll be right back, but okay. I can continue to hear you as you talk of...
Well, right now I will talk of station breaks and say that this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifico Radio at 99.5 FM. My name is Jim Freund. The program is Hour of the Wolf. My guest on Skype, I'm going to turn down his mic while he bustles around his loft. We'll hear him when he comes back, is a novelist and producer and critic, Terrence Taylor. And we are discussing, as you can tell, the new form, a new form that has come. Terrence has done an excellent job in finding antecedents of this form. It's like saying, oh, this has never been done before, like cyberpunk never existed before Bill Gibson, except that it existed with John Brunner and Shockwave Rider and... You know, and there were cyberpunk novels that were written in the 60s and 50s. And I think this is a similar kind of a thing. But I think that the medium is opening up, and I'm finding it very exciting. And I dare say that while this program is generally about literary science fiction, we are, you know, right now in a golden age of television. another golden age of television. And since when people are in the midst of it, they don't necessarily recognize it as such. They don't see it as such. But there is so much good stuff, well written, well acted, well produced, with original writing. Things like Fargo, which you can discuss seasons 1, 2, or 3, and if you like the movie, and all of these four things are completely distinct from each other. There will be tips and nods. A character in season 3 of Fargo also appeared in season 1. And by the way, there are nods in season 3 of Fargo that refer to Legion, since they're written and directed by the same guy. Why not? And we don't know if there's a Fargo 4, by the way, because Noah Hawley is too busy working on Legion Season 2. So we're going to see where that goes. Terrence, you're back with us. Do you want to take calls?
If there are some, sure.
Well, if
we ask
for them, we might get some. The telephone number, if you would like to talk on this subject, over WBAI in New York, is area code 347-335-0818. I cannot think of a less mnemonic phone number that we have ever had in all the years I've worked here. 347-335-0818. And again, I ask people, stick to the subject of what we are discussing. If it is too peripheral, we'll say thank you very much and allow somebody else. It's funny, we've been getting phone calls all during the show, and now that I say it, you know, it's like, okay, no more calls. By the way, the co-author of Legion, the original, is the graphic artist, and I hope I pronounce this correctly, Bill Sienkiewicz.
Yes.
Sienkiewicz. And I think that's probably a good guess at the pronunciation of the name of the person who works with Chris Claremont. Anyway, yeah. Chris is a friend. I can get away with that. I can try anyway. 347-335-0818 if you would like to speak with Terrence Taylor and or me on the subject of the morning on Hour of the Wolf. And Terrence, if you had, aside from your own Vampire Testament works, if you had a literary property, or for that matter, a media property that you would like seen given this kind of multi-seasonal treatment where each season is a different thing, we haven't even discussed a show that I'm unlikely to watch, which is American Horror Story, which does the same kind of thing. It's an anthology series where each season is a separate arc.
There's issues with it, though. I mean, it's like, God.
But I'm just saying it's form. I'm discussing the form. Anyway, if there is a property that you would like to see brought to this kind of form, what might it be? It's a good question.
If you could have dinner with anyone in history, who would it be?
Yeah. It's one of those questions, correct.
Well, see, the thing, I would love to see some of Cronenberg, specifically Videodrome. There's talk of remaking Videodrome, which has such rife potential for disaster. I don't know if you have you ever seen David Cronenberg's Videodrome?
I actually have, believe it or not. I like
it. It's a brilliantly surreal film. Cronenberg to me has made two surrealist features. One was Naked Lunch.
He's made a lot more than two. Yes.
And one was Videodrome.
Yeah.
Because Videodrome at a certain point in the film just dispenses with reality as we know it and enters a very dreamlike space where illogical, impossible things are happening, but they're actually happening. And there is a question at one point, is it hallucination? Is it real? Is it not real? And that same ambiguity between real and unreal runs through Naked Lunch, where you have the character waking up on a pile of sand on the beach, coming back from the interzone and things like that.
Which
I love
the
scene where
that starred, oh God help me,
Peter Weller.
The Chris Eccleston as video game designer.
In what?
That's what I'm trying to remember. In what? Are these people in the video game or not? I'll look up.
Oh, are you talking about...
it was a movie.
Wait, stop for a second. Wait, are you talking about the Cronenberg game film with... hang on. Oh, God. It was a play on words. Existence.
Yeah, that's the one.
You know, it's funny. I saw Existence right after The Matrix. And it did not benefit from that because The Matrix, the first, we had not known at that point there would be two more that would soil the memory of that initial joy so terribly.
Well, I thought but, Matrix soiled itself. But yeah.
But the thing is that the concept of people living in virtual reality was done so brilliantly in the original Matrix that when I saw Existence afterwards, it sort of seemed a thin echo. It later, seeing it more in isolation away from the other film with time passing, it actually benefits. It holds up better.
Yeah, I think
but,
so.
But going back to Videodrome, the basic premise of Videodrome was a conspiracy. It was about, at the time, weird public access video cables, channels where bizarre stuff is going on. You get scrambled channels that are doing S&M murders. Snuff video, basically.
Yeah. By the way, we are getting calls now, so anytime.
Oh, okay. But they're talking about remaking it as a film, but as a series, there's a lot there to explore that
could
be very
yes,
interesting.
I can see that. I can see that.
Yeah.
Okay. So
because all you really need for the series is a viable universe
with
depth.
The calls disappear, by the way,
enough
to
explore.
Soon. It's a technical glitch at BAI. They actually disappear. So let me put this person on the air. And say, good morning, you're on the radio. Hello? Yep, you see, and it disappeared. That's
oh
what
my
happens.
God, it's like...
What happens,
okay.
It rings
now
about...
Grab the next one fast.
It rings... well, we only get one call at a time. The technical capabilities here are very, very limited. So I will ask,
welcome to the future, folks.
You know, of the,
and modern
the future
radio.
Of WBAI.
We can take one call.
The future
at a time
of
and it...
WBAI is a very unclear one. If people have been listening to the current goings on,
they've heard it before
may,
the
that
show
we may
again.
Be losing
yeah,
our.
So quite...
Let me please say this: that we may be losing our lease at the Empire State Building within a few days, and then we will not be broadcasting. And if people want to learn more about this, go to WBAI.org. Okay, so I, you know, that's sort of important. So I needed to say that. I told you about that off air.
I also heard it before your show.
Yeah, just before my
There's
show.
There's a lengthy, lucid explanation of the situation. Yeah,
there is. So let me ask people to, but among other technical issues is the fact that we really have only one incoming phone line that I'm aware of. And that is at 347-335-0818. And I'm always hearing from various people in the tech department, oh, no, the other lines work. Well, outgoing, yeah. But I've never gotten another call on anything except we have a phone that shows 12 lines, and I've only ever seen calls come in on line number one. You can make outgoing calls on the others, but that's not how it works. People call in. They check in, they don't check out. I had forgotten that Sarah Pauly was in Existence. I'm looking at the cast. And Don McKellar.
Huh.
Interesting cast. Okay, so the call is back. Or it's somebody else. Good morning.
Rabbit.
You are on the radio.
You know, James, you've been off the air for a couple of minutes.
I didn't know that. But
yes,
but we are nonetheless still online.
Oh, are you taking calls? I just...
We're on the air.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Good morning, Terrence Taylor.
Good morning.
I wanted to ask you a question. By the way, I totally agree. With the exception of American Gods, I think, and I've said it in a review that I'm rapidly finishing up for a couple of folklore and story websites on the new Neil Gaiman, I think it's the best thing he's done yet, bar none. Hmm. Or as Walter Brennan said, no brag, just fact. I love anything Gaiman does, but I think this is a great book. I wish I'd had this book when I was teaching this stuff long time
ago. Are you talking about Norse gods or American gods?
No, Norse mythology.
No, Norse mythology. It's very, very good. It's not, of course, it's studies that Neil has done and wrote, moved along by Elisa Quitney. It's not Neil's original fiction.
Oh, no. I know it's not fiction, but I mean,
it's a valuable text.
No, it's a great text.
It's a great text.
For school purposes.
Yes,
especially.
But we're not. But it doesn't relate to Neil Gaiman as a fiction writer.
No. I want to ask Terrence a question. One of the characters that you included last week, since you did a reading, and I'm curious how you got him into the act, is Mad Tom. Am I correct that this is Mad Tom of Bedlam?
Yeah,
yes,
well, he
it
did
is.
Spell it out, yes.
And I'm curious, by the way, James, thank you for playing Jazz Vampire, but you realize that since he did include Mad Tom...
Stay on topic.
What? Yeah, no. I just wanted to know how you got... what gave you the idea to get him into the act?
Well, may I digress for a moment? Well, it was still on topic because I would love to see it adapted into a Netflix series.
No, that's on topic because that's from last week's
conversation. Yeah. Tom was introduced in the first book and then locked up. In the second book, he's freed, but more or less contained until the end of the novel, at which point he's unleashed in a way that he was never capable of being before, and essentially has control of an organization with international connections and an open door to pretty much every world leader on the planet, which is a really bad thing for a vampire to have because they can just go bite them and tell them to obey them, which is more or less what he does over the next 20 years. So the third novel is set 20 years in the future, and Tom has been out of the box for 20 years. Now, here's the interesting thing about that is that it's taken me some time to get to the third novel because it was so scary to me and I wasn't sure where to go with it, and it the work of the last year got me there. But the first two are separated by 20 years. The second two are separated by 20 years. That means that the second book took place in 2006-07. The third one takes place in 2027, which was at the time of the writing of the second book 20 years in the future. I now find myself in 2017 writing this book that's set 10 years into a dystopian future. And at a certain point, it was like, okay, well, what am I doing? Anything I do, you have to sort of be able to believe that it's going to be plausible in 10 years. And even if the book took 4 years to come out, it's still 5 years in the future. But it's got to be a dystopian future that we can get to from here. But looking around... If Tom of Bedlam was out of the box and influencing international politics to bring chaos to the world, to reduce us down to the sole survivors who are worth saving, he has done a damn good job in the last 10 years. Because we're as close to being halfway to my future apocalypse as we could possibly get, which was a very depressing revelation.
You know, that he showed up, I should tell you, he showed up in a song that was included as far back as the year 1680. In a manuscript collection called Pills to Purge Melancholy.
Yes. Which is actually where I got his name.
Because
around the time period that he was created. And he had, there was a Molly as well in the song. There was another song that was sung by Molly about her Tom of Bedlam.
Yes. So
and then there was
a call
specific
and response
song about
on
Tom
that.
Himself.
Yeah. Yes, James has played that a number of times.
Yeah, but there's a rooted character there that I built on and totally deliberately from that source. The song itself, I wish I could remember the lyrics. I cited some of the lyrics in the second novel because I have him singing parts of it, you know, and it's very perverse.
Well, the first verse goes,
what?
Oh, to see Mad Tom of Bedlam, 10,000 miles I travel, Mad Maudlin goes on dirty toes for to save her shoes from gravel.
Yep, that's it. Maud, not Molly. Mad Maud.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
Maud.
I want to ask you one last question about American Gods, the series, the TV series.
Yes.
How is Anansi treated? Is he treated as a trickster culture hero, or is he treated as an actual deity?
Yet unknown.
Yes and no. There are two – part of the issue that I have with the series is
there are multiple versions of – the gods. There's the American god and there's the African god.
No. But specifically, to deal with Anansi as the character in the series, he's mm-hmm. made two appearances.
Mm-hmm.
The first appearance was wonderful and made me really want to see him again, because he appears on a slave ship that's on its way to the New World. Mm-hmm. And he essentially shows up in a sort of like 50s hipster jazz drag outfit. I mean, he's like in the suit, this slick little tight suit, this shirt, the hat. I mean, he's totally like a jazz hipster.
And
he's laying down. The truth is,
he's on screen, they play bebop.
Right. So he's like Jazzbo. I mean, and he's basically laying down the truth that their lives are just going to get worse. And you may as well just burn it all down and make a statement with your death, because nothing is going to get better for you or your descendants for the next couple hundred years. He then reappears later.
Yeah, well,
and it's interesting.
The point is actually that the first time we see him, he is only coming across to the New World as the slaves are. Later on, he has become something else altogether. He runs a mortuary.
No.
Yes.
No, Jim, think for a moment. I don't know if I'm thinking of episode 8. No, the guy who runs the mortuary is the death figure.
Yes.
He is the figure that the wife sees.
That's also Osiris, yes.
Yes, but he's Osiris. He is not Anansi. Anansi is played by another actor. He then reappears in the series as a tailor, Mr. Nancy.
Yes.
When Wednesday and Shadow go to get dressed up to go visit Easter. Episode 7
that's,
or 8?
No, that's 8. That's 8.
That's 8.
Okay.
So, Mr. Nancy, you haven't seen his second appearance
okay.
yet. He's only
so
been
you know,
seen
so you, so you know what's happened? They in the book, it's Mr. Nancy at the mortuary. So they substituted Osiris for Nancy.
Yes.
You know, it's interesting.
Which makes much more sense, though.
You know, it's interesting.
He is as the god of death. So the thing is, Anansi is treated very much as a deity coming over from Africa with slaves, but essentially encouraging them to chaos,
mm-hmm.
which makes him a trickster god. And his role as a tailor in creating outfits and telling stories about Sheba, he tells another story about Sheba, so we get her progression, is basically the spider is spinner. The spider spins webs, he spins tails, he also makes them their suits. He becomes a tailor. But as Mr. Nancy, he also becomes this slightly quasi-gay tailor, you know? He's not playing it he's a Nancy. He's not a Nancy, he's a Nancy.
He's a Nancy boy. Yes, but that is actually a major departure from the book.
Yes, it is.
As we have seen, by episode 7, you're well off book.
And you know, Terrence, it's interesting.
By episode 3, you're off book.
You mentioned Mr. Nancy. You know, when Anansi reached the West Indies, some very interesting things happened. Instead of...
Not relevant to American gods, though.
No. Well,
I'm curious, because it is part
of
it.
Well, in the southern U.S., Anansi often became Aunt Nancy. And if the mothers would say to the kids, if you misbehave, Aunt Nancy will get you.
I'll have to look that one up. I hadn't heard that variation.
Southern U.S., especially the Appalachians.
Well, but again, you know, the sort of gay underscoring of the auntie, you know, in black culture, you know, is sort of like the gay guy down the block who's the auntie to all the kids. So they brought that aspect into the character of the series.
By the way,
I hope he comes back. I mean, he's...
I hope he does, too.
I could remember the name of the actor playing him.
If you know the book, then you know he'll be back.
Well, ultimately, they all have to come back for the big battle as it goes out over the next season. But I just love the way
don't think the battle is going to really come down to everything next season. I think we're going to be marking more time, and the real big battle is going to start happening in season 3.
But that's my complaint. I don't want it dragged out that long. Do you know how pissed I got? I can say it in that context. When I was watching the first Hobbit movie, because I'm sitting there watching the first Hobbit movie without realizing there were going to be two more, and I'm sitting there watching it, and I'm waiting for Smaug the dragon to come up, because I love dragons.
They're going
to
wait for 3 hours, yeah.
and I love really well done Digital Dragons, and they do this quick pan along the tail and go to credits, and I'm like, you bastards, I can't believe you're dragging it out for two more movies, aren't you? And sure enough, I had to wait ages to get to that damn dragon. Well, but it's like, just make up some more story. Finish this one off quick. You've established the universe. Go anywhere you want at that point, but don't just keep dragging.
Yeah, by the way, it is, believe it or not, playing Mr. Nancy, it is none other than Orlando Jones.
Yes, that's his name. I love Orlando Jones. He was on, what was the comedy show he was on? It was like Fridays, Saturdays. There was one of those ensemble cast Saturday Night Live ripoff shows.
Well, he was on Mad TV.
Mad TV, that's what it was. But he was great on that. And he did a lot of other good fun stuff.
But by the way, American Gods, last question and I'll go. Did they give the Queen of Sheba a name?
Yes.
Because in most of the stories, her name is Bilquis.
Yes, her name is Bilquis. They don't call they don't call her the Queen of Sheba in the show. They only call her Bilquis.
Yeah, and that's what she's listed as the credits. I went and cheated and went and looked at the wiki pages, and they explained who she was supposed to be just because I was very curious because I didn't know the name. And
I think it's very interesting, by the way, that the leprechaun is being played by Pablo Schreiber. It was apparently a last moment substitute in actors. The fellow who was doing it had to leave mid-filming, and they had to refilm scenes with Pablo Schreiber, who's great in the role.
Oh, yes. No, he's doing a very funny job.
By the way,
he's the biggest leprechaun I've ever seen in my life.
By the way,
which is very funny,
too.
On,
they introduce us to some Slavic deities. There are some neat ones in the right
in the beginning. Chernobog is in there.
Chernobog? Oh, very good.
From episode two. So, yeah.
Okay, guys.
Been there, done that.
Okay. And we've got the matron, crone, and maiden, too, all lined up. Okay, well, thank you much. Thank you. We will talk to you soon.
Yeah, Peter Stormare as Chernobog.
He was a riot. He's such a perverse little actor. He's done some great genre work, and I saw him in something the other day that was he's getting to do more interesting stuff, which is nice because
I haven't spotted exactly who she is in the series, but I have a friend in the show. When I say friend, I'm talking about somebody who I knew 30 years ago when I worked at a talent agency as a residuals clerk, but Beth Grant, who you probably don't know. She plays Jack. I don't recall who. I'm looking, of course, at IMDb. But I noticed her name in the credits.
Jack in American Gods?
Yes.
Who's Jack?
I'm not sure. But she's a fine, fine actress who's done a lot of work, a lot of theater, tons of movies. And she's playing Jack in American Gods, but in the movie Jackie, she plays Lady Bird. But I knew her, as I say, some 30 years ago. And I got to know a whole lot of people because I wrote their residuals check. So everybody from Alfred Drake to Joan Fontaine had to come into my office to get paid.
That would make sure that you got to see people once a week. Now, what's her name again?
I'm Beth Grant.
I'm doing Jack American Gods, and nothing is coming up. But
and she's in every Brian Fuller show ever. She's in Pushing Daisies, and
she was in Twin Peaks. She was hang on. Yes, it was Twin Peaks. She was partnered with she ended up with one eye on Twin Peaks.
That was her? Really? Okay.
Yes.
I didn't realize that was, okay. Now we're talking about the original, of course.
I haven't seen the new stuff
yet.
Yeah,
neither have I. Although it does fit into this conversation, doesn't it?
Interesting. Yes, it does. Although that's really just continuing a TV series. It wasn't adapted from anything.
Yeah, but it was an example of the kind of arc-based television that we're discussing.
Jack's Crocodile Bar?
Yes. Remember the bar where Mad Sweeney first challenges?
Oh, yeah. I saw her behind the counter. Yes. I remember her now. Yes.
Oh, of course. She's the owner of the bar.
Yeah, she's the owner of the bar, for God's sake.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, well, it was 30 years ago that she'd come into my office and I'd write her.
And she wasn't wearing an eye patch from Twin Peaks, so.
No, she wasn't wearing an eye patch when I gave her checks. She looked both eyes.
But no, I would, Videodrome has potential to like be fleshed out into a series of some kind. I could see that universe, you know, building. It's a dark conspiracy, noirish conspiracy. I don't know, you know, there's plenty of like young, fascinating actresses who could like take over the Debbie Harry role in the original and mm-hmm. give it the same kind of frisson. What else is out there?
I'd like to see Deborah Harry back.
Well, yeah.
But you know, one of the things, the only thing that I am worried about here.
They could actually bring her back as her original character in the original film.
Is that Brian Fuller has had a lot of bad luck with some of his TV series. Like, especially, for example, Pushing Daisies, which I loved. I thought it was a wonderful show. And then right, you know, mid-swing, they cancel it, right?
Kristen Chenoweth makes a great little appearance in episode 8.
Yes, I know. Happy Easter. But I never saw Hannibal, but Dead Like Me, Pushing Daisies, all shows that died before their time. He will be working on the forthcoming Amazing Stories. He left Star Trek. He's one of the co-creators, along with Alex Kurtzman, of Star Trek Discovery. But and he made his debut, by the way, writing for Star Trek. For DS9 and Voyager, or V'ger, as I call it. And from there, he went to Wonderfalls, Dead Like Me, Pushing Daisies. He did a thing called Heroes. Remember that? He did the first season only. Heroes went south when Brian Fuller left for other pastures, including, by the way, Mockingbird Lane, which was a one-off. That should have been a TV series. It was The Munsters as a one-hour, not necessarily all that funny show. It was genius.
Yeah, I wasn't wild about it.
I loved it. I thought, you know, it's like, guess what? Grandpa's actually a vampire and behaves like one. And that had never been done. And I really remember, all you saw was a pilot. Had they made it into the series it deserved to be. So anyway, Fuller was working on two shows at once. One was American Gods. The other was Star Trek Discovery. And Alex Kurtzman, who has written and worked on some rather good things, has also written and worked on some rather lousy things, including a recent movie that, give me a minute and I can tell you what it is, because I can look it up. But Brian Fuller had to leave Star Trek because he couldn't work on two major projects at the same time. It's very understandable. And I'm glad. I wish more people had the wisdom to not spread out too far. Stephen Moffat, I'm talking to you. what's Alex Kurtzman's most recent bomb? The new Transformers movie.
Oh dear.
Yeah, and The Mummy. Oh, The Mummy, that's it.
Oh dear.
Yeah, The Mummy, and coming up, Van Helsing.
Oh God.
The Invisible Man.
Oh Lord.
Bride of Frankenstein.
Spare me.
And he's taken over from Brian Fuller, or co-written with Brian Fuller, and now Fuller has left in order to focus on American Jobs. Kurtzman is sole primary executive producer, the showrunner, as they like to say, of Star Trek Discovery. Which I think would have been so much better had Brian Fuller stayed with it. But I have to say, I'm so pleased with American Gods. I'm glad that Fuller made the choice he did. And I just hope that it doesn't befall the fate his other shows did.
Well, we'll see.
We will see.
I mean, I wasn't very big on The Dead Show. It was like, they seemed awfully whiny, and I never really got into it.
Dead Like Me?
Yeah, where
Swoozy Kurtz and Kristen Chenoweth could just burst into song for no reason. I loved it.
Yeah, it wasn't grabbing. Isn't that the other one?
Mm-hmm.
The one at the pie shop? Is that the one that used to burst into song?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Pushing Daisies.
I was going to say, I don't remember anyone bursting into song in Dead Like Me. A little too much.
Oh, even though it had Mandy Patinkin in it, yeah.
Yeah, it's a little too much adolescent angst. What was the other one after that? It was...
Well, before that was Wonderful.
Yeah, I never saw Wonderful.
Yeah, that's the one I didn't love. I saw...
No, but what came after Dead Like Me? You had mentioned it
Hannibal.
Earlier. Oh, really wasn't into Hannibal. I mean, you would think, me, of all people, that I would have been glued to the set. But it was like, part of the problem for me was that it seemed to be a continuation of the Michael Mann movie.
Yes.
As opposed to the other film series. And I really had hated Michael Mann's adaptation of, what was the first book? He did it, I think he did it as Manhunter, but what was it? It was
Red Dragon. Red Dragon.
Red Dragon. I really hated his adaptation of Red Dragon, though there were.
It had its moments.
But mostly it had to do with the lead. The lead was so much the unshaven, sullen, damaged hero that he had done in Miami Vice and everything else he was doing.
Well, he
that it really kind of ruined it for me. And I didn't think – and that was the problem I had with the Hannibal series, was that it seemed to pick up from the tone of Manhunter. And I hadn't liked that. So the whole relationship between Lecter – and I can't remember the detective's name.
Clarice
right now.
Sparrow.
No. Not in Red Dragon. Not in Hannibal. Clarice.
No. That's right. Clarice isn't in that.
It's the cop from Manhunter from Red Dragon. I can't think of his name right now. I want to say Jack something.
Yeah.
But whatever it is, you know, I saw Hannibal didn't grab me. I mean, of all the things that he's done, probably American Gods is the thing I'm finding myself the most interested in. But some of the flaws in the earlier work are still sort of there, sort of whimsical looseness that, I don't know, somehow we'll see where it goes with American Gods.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see. So far, I've really enjoyed it. I think that it's a very good example, more so than Game of Thrones and some of the other things, of fulfilling the potential of bringing literary work to episodic TV.
Mm-hmm. My only concern is that at a certain point the symbiosis becomes too great and it starts destroying written work, that publishers only start publishing books they think can be made into TV series. People only start writing books that seem to have the potential. I mean, I've been making a joke for the last year that I'm not writing a short story anymore that's not a movie pitch.
you know?
But I realize at a certain point, I stopped joking. I'm working on a story now. It's like, this could be such a great movie. And it's like, okay, that should not be the motivating factor for writing a short story. But
by the way, the
success
actor,
spurs those sort of things, and we'll see what happens.
The actor in question, by the way, was William Peterson.
In Manhunter.
Yes.
Yes, I know.
Yeah.
I never liked him.
No,
he ended up with that TV series for years, though. He did very well with it. Playing the forensic guy.
Mm-hmm. No, he's a good actor. I just think he was
miscast.
Which was it?
Hello?
And I think that, Mike...
Did I lose you?
Hello?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
I don't hear you.
You don't hear me. Are you listening on your Bluetooth? Are you listening on your radio?
No,
how
this
are
is
you?
Interesting.
Well, you know, we're here. We can hear you. Don't curse.
Oh, wait. My headphones may have gone out.
Yeah, you're doing your Bluetooth thing, aren't you? You can't hear me say that. So So I'll just remind people that this is WBAI in New York City.
Still hear me.
Listener-sponsored station intermittently broadcasting at 99.5 FM, but continually webcasting at WBAI.org, where the show will also be available on archive. And my name is Jim Freund. With me on Skype, trying to fix his headphone, is Terrence Taylor, and we are discussing, the new form of long-term Hello? Serial TV. We can hear you. Can you hear us?
Can you hear me?
Yes. We keep saying yes. I guess you can't hear me. Do you want to try dialing back in? On Skype, should I hang up on you and call you again? If you're not hearing me, then, what can I say? Turn on your internet. You can hear us at WBAI.org. So whether we are broadcasting or not, okay, I heard your keyboard. Does that mean that you're messaging me? I can't hear you anymore. I will type you back. We hear you. This is great. We're doing texting as radio. And we can hear him typing. Two letters. Jeez. Where's Lister? Does he know that he's on today?
Ah, can you hear me now?
Yes, we've been able to hear you all the time.
That's rather annoying because I lost you somehow. I just managed to reconnect everything. So I hope you were entertaining yourself for the last 5 minutes. Sorry about that.
No, we were all...
For that reason, my headphones went out and I suddenly couldn't hear anything.
So. Oh, because of the batteries. Okay, well,
wireless headphones.
This is what you get for living your life wirelessly.
It's true. It's true. Things need power and they just go right out. Well, where did I last seem sentient?
No, I don't know. We had finished Manhunter and William Peterson and all
William Peterson, yeah, but he had a TV series. What was it? He was it was one of the CSI shows, I think. He was like the head forensic guy. He had a
I've never seen any that. Of the CSI shows, believe it or not.
Yeah, you haven't missed a great deal. Some of them are amusing, but
he was in he's listed as a producer. He was in the main one, Crime Scene Investigation.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Oh, and then in CSI Immortality.
Oh, weird. That vaguely rings a weird bell.
According to IMDb, that was a TV movie in 2015.
Huh. Interesting. At any rate. But yes, Manhunter, I was not a big fan of. There was someone who had actually said that the actor and portrayal of Lecter in it was actually quite good, and it isn't bad.
Ryan Cox is a great actor.
Yeah, no, he did a very nice job with it, a very different approach than the other one. And there are good things. I mean, the whole fire in the wheelchair reporter scene is like,
oh God, yes, 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 yes.
And that was very true to the book. I mean, ironically, Manhunter, I think, is almost truer to the book than the actual Red Dragon movie was. But
when you say the actual Red Dragon movie, basically you had a genius movie, the Jodie Foster film of Silence of the Lambs, and it went so well they said, oh, well, sequel.
Let's adapt them all.
Yeah, exactly. And so as long as we've got Hopkins, we can go as far as we want. And so they remade Red Dragon, which had already,
largely because they wanted to have that package of the trilogy all made in the same style. And that could be a box set, and then even Hannibal, became part of that as well. Yeah. And the Hannibal Rising then became the fourth piece of that package. So
the fourth one in the trilogy. Exactly.
Yes, yes, which was like, oh, God, That actor, he was also like evil Picard clone in Nemesis. I mean, he sort of made his living being irritating youth.
Believe it or not, I have as much of a Trek fan, especially Next Gen, as I am. I've never seen Nemesis.
Not, I don't think it's as bad as some people claim. It's got its appeal in its own funny little way.
Well, you know, I'd rather imagine it.
Well, it probably benefits from that.
Yeah, I think that may very well be the case. By the way, it is in New York City, almost 252. Usually Lister is well here by this time. And if he is not, we're going to have to find something else to put on the air at 3 a.m. because I am not staying on till 5. I have had a very, very long... I'll tell you about it when next I see you, hopefully this weekend. It's been quite a day. It's been quite a day dealing with hospitals and not me but a friend, and yelling at a cop who threatened to arrest me, and it was a fun day. I only got home at 10 p.m. Whereupon I watched episode 7 of American Gods and some pizza and came here.
I would have eaten the pizza instead of watching it myself. But...
Yes, exactly. Well, there was a lot of the pie. So I watched the pie, but I ate some slices.
There you go.
But, you know, just saying that in theory we are done here in about 4 minutes or so, but not counting outro, I thought I saw a program director in the hallways. I'm not sure about that, but I thought I saw that, and I may ask him, what shall we do about this?
You would think that would be the appropriate person to ask that question of.
Yeah, I would think so. Well, I know what's supposed to go on at 5 a.m. and to set that up, but we need 2 hours before that. Maybe we'll do all mixed ups. All mixed up. It's been misspelled. But there's a 2 hour version of that. And I'm sure it's been played before, but we can play it again if I can set it up correctly, which I think I can.
Lister may still appear.
Listen, well, yeah, but he's usually here by about 2:15.
I know.
And it's now 2:54.
I know. It's sort of unusual for him.
It is unusual for him. But you see, there have been confused signals about our being on the air tonight because we
were... Oh, that's true.
He may not know. One source told me not to come in, that we, our transmitter would be off and there is no radio. And another source from the operations department said all producers are required to come in and do their shows for benefit of the stream, which, by the way, makes all the sense in the world to me. So whether or not we are broadcasting, and right now I suspect perhaps we're not, according to what Robert said earlier. But let me just see, because I've got a radio on in another room, and I would hear it because we're on delay. No, I think we're not on the broadcast, but we are on the internet and streaming.
All hail the stream.
All hail the stream. Now, you see, that the stream, that would make one of the an interesting new god, wouldn't it?
We all worship the stream.
Yes, in so many ways.
Excuse me.
Yes, that was good for a throat clearing.
Well, I've been sitting here nibbling salmon jerky, which is probably the most frightening concept in the world, because it's like it sort of tastes salmon-y, but it's like chewing bark, or not bark. If bark were chewy and hard to break up with your teeth. I don't understand how you can do that to salmon.
Oh, no, it's such I'm a tender, flaky fish. Delay. Why is that?
I don't know what they do to it to make it like shoe leather, because it's such a flaky fish. But yet, that's the problem with Whole Foods being 2-3 blocks away. You walk in, you see stupid things like this. It's like, sure, I'll try that for $6.99. God knows it'll last, because God knows it does. It takes a long time to eat a bag of salmon jerky, that's for sure.
You Amazon Foods you're talking about, right?
But I suddenly,
Amazon Foods.
Yes, Amazon Foods. Will they now be like, well, people keep making drone jokes. I keep making jokes about, will women archers be now ringing us out at the Amazon market? People were like, oh, we hate them now because they're Amazon. I'm like, when did we start hating Amazon? And then I was like, but didn't we hate Whole Foods before because the owner was such a person
jerk
that we of disinterest that he said stupid things about Obamacare? We all hated him anyway, even though we kept shopping because it's so damn convenient and they get sales every now and then.
But now,
so, I mean, how would we hate them more than we hated them under him with Amazon?
No, not at all. You know, it's like, look at it this way. People seem to ignore that the new owner of Whole Foods is also the person who runs the Washington Post.
Well, there we go. How can we hate the owner of the Washington Post?
I mean, the Washington Post has done some wonderful things for the world in the last few months. So,
well, maybe Amazon will... there we did answer my text saying, well, you can't... I should have thought of texting you earlier. But yes, I mean, it'll be interesting to see what happens. Maybe they'll start adding books to the shelves. Who knows?
Yeah, so...
I don't see it much changing things.
Yeah, probably... Well, we'll see. It will change Amazon, if not Whole Foods.
Well,
I think Whole Foods will stay what it is, but I think it's also going to start being a waypoint for distribution. And in that sense, it's Amazon has now gotten a brick and mortar store in every major neighborhood in the country.
So they can set up a corner where you can pick up your Amazon packages, and they
That's exactly it. That's exactly it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll see. We'll see.
Listen, we got 1 minute before I have to go off the air.
Read my books, Bite Marks and Blood Pressure. There we go.
Okay.
Do you believe in vampires.com?
Yeah, don't you have terrencetaylor.com?
I do. They go to the same place.
Well, okay,
but
it's Terrence with one R, you know.
Yes, Terrence Taylor, like Terrence Stamp.
Yes, with one R. Exactly.
So for those who remember, you know, Zod the Untouchable or whatever his name was.
General Zod.
General Zod. Well,
yes, the real one, not the fake one of recent years.
Oh,
and here's Lister, just in time. Just
realizing he was going to be on air, and he's arrived in time.
Yeah, absolutely. So we are saved. I'm going to put on Sales of Silver. Actually, you and I will speak for another minute before I start Sales of Silver, since he just walked in.
He'll give him a second to breathe and get adjusted before he leaves.
And release the dreadlocks. It's like, you know, it's like being on a ship.
Release the dreadlocks!
Yes.
Like Unleash the Kraken?
Yeah, well, that's exactly Unleash the Kraken. Yes, exactly. That's exactly it. Is it Kraken or Kraken?
I always said Kraken myself.
I've always said Kraken, but I heard somebody on some fictional, well, it's a real TV show, but a TV show of fiction referring to the Kraken. And I thought, no, that's just wrong. It's the Kraken. Let's get Kraken.
Oh, that suddenly makes me want to pronounce it differently. It kind of diminishes the whole thing.
It does. Where, Terrence, should our listeners be next Thursday, a week from tonight at 7 p.m.?
I can't imagine. Might you be hosting an amusing event?
Absolutely not.
No, I'm not hosting.
Paul Witkover is hosting it.
Yes.
I will introduce it. But it is the New York Review of Science Fiction readings at 388 Atlantic Avenue, admission free, donations accepted, with Paul Witkover and Rosaline Maltese as the readers. And Paul will be the host.
How many Falcon jokes has she had to withstand over the course of her life?
I know not, but...
I'll bite my tongue. I'll try not to.
If one meets her, and you have met her, the moment you see her, you'll go, oh, I know you.
Okay.
Yeah, she comes to a lot of the readings, and she works with Ellen Kushner, and she's a really cool, wonderful human being. And she's one of the cereal box people, by the way, as is Paul. So these are sort of like the leftover gift packages from Cereal Box.
The Box Tops, as it were?
Yes. Oh, very good. Very good. Wasn't that a band?
There may have been.
Wasn't that like a doo-wop band?
It was so odd. I was listening to radio the other day. KCRW, I think it was on the weekend. I was writing, and I started listening to the live shows over the weekend because it's just
You let me
life.
Know when you're ready, Lister, and I'll make way.
Yes. But the funny thing was that Henry, now I'm blocking his name of the whole story, has no point whatsoever. Rock and roller, has been doing movies and TV shows for years, but he has a radio show. Oh, God, this is ridiculous. Henry, you know who I'm talking about.
No, maybe I do.
The story makes no – well, I have no time to look him up either. I feel stupid having started this. But the funny thing is that he's like this – he's like from the era of Black Flag. He was like in a band like that. Henry – I can't think of his last name. And he's like got this radio show, but he's talking like an FM DJ on like an old-time jazz show. Mm-hmm. So when he's talking, it's like he's talking in the same tone of voice, like he's introducing like about – to introduce like a 1920s jazz song or something. Yeah, so-and-so did this, and he did this in such and such time, and such and such and such and such. And then he plays like power guitar chords, and it's like Black Flag or something. And I was like, oh, this is like a really good show. But why is the disc jockey sound like someone's dead in between tracks? And it was so funny. And then they introduce him, and I've got to find his name now. It's driving me crazy.
Yeah, well, what can I say?
Henry Rollins.
Oh, my God.
Henry Rollins. Even as I was getting ready to write, I was starting to type Henry. He's like, it's Henry Rollins. You know Henry Rollins.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, my God, Henry Rollins sounds like someone's dead now. It's like, I've gotten so old. He sounds like a late-night jazz show DJ.
But I remember Except Henry Rollins from Ragtime. Like he was great. Rock. Yeah.
But it was just so disconcerting. It was like, because he sounds like so friendly and nice and casual and nice. This is a guy who's, I mean, he didn't roll in glass like Iggy Pop, but it was a step away.
Yeah.
But very funny. It was like, what? I guess I didn't recognize the voice at all.
Yeah.
Much less the affect. And then suddenly he's like, so this is Henry Rollins. I was like, Henry Rollins? I was like, that now? This is so wrong. When did they tame him? What did they take the drugs away? What happened? It was very odd.
Indeed. So, Lister, are you about ready? I'm going to miss my bus. He's ready. Terrence, thank you.
I will talk to you soon.
Very soon. We have to figure out the weekend.
Yes. Okay. I'll talk to you later.
Okay, take care. Thank you. So, and thank everybody for listening. I am going to get out of here and turn the... I'm not sure, by the way, Lister. I don't believe we are broadcasting. I believe we are just webcasting, which was what was originally predicted. But when I started at 1 a.m., we were broadcasting. And somewhere in the middle of the show, we just went off the air. But that's fine because I was assuming it was going to be just a webcast anyway. You know, well, in theory, I don't want to use any of the indecent language because what if it comes back? But in theory, if we're not broadcasting, then the F-CC has nothing to say about the language we use. The rules of the web apply rather than the rules of broadcast. The FCC holds no sway outside of their destruction of net neutrality over web content. They have no say over web content. So, but I dare say it is best to play it somewhat safe. But I would think that if we are only webcasting, then anything goes.
With Cherry Oak.
Yeah, but I wouldn't be certain. I think the transmitter, considering the kind of work they're doing, may go off and on, off and on. Anything. So tonight, I wouldn't take chances. Okay. After we, let's hope we don't lose our lease at Empire, which is supposed to happen within the next week. So we'll see what happens.
Isn't that the second time that is happening?
No. First, no, this is it. There's a motion for, one has to keep up with the news. This is a very, very big deal. before it was threats. Now the judge has to decide on July 1st. So we're there. I'm sure there will be legal stuff to go on, but we are hoping that politicians will get involved, right, and especially progressive politicians, yes, and consider the value of WBAI and share their good thoughts for the legalistic, financially questionable issues that we believe Empire has done.
Is the judge Judge Bork?
Well, actually, Bork wouldn't be that bad compared to others. Okay, who's Facebooking me and why? I don't like... Okay, Henry Rollins' radio went out about an hour and a half ago, Jim. Okay, yeah. An hour and a half ago? Really? That long? Yeah, so anyhow, only Webstream got us on right now. Okay, well, we're on the Webstream. So, yeah. So thank you for that Facebook message. At any rate, it's high time for me to get out of here. My bus is at 3:13. Otherwise, I have to spend $20 to get home.
I'll carry you on my back.
Okay, you do your show. I'm going to play Sales of Silver. Thank you for listening. I'll be back next week on web or broadcast or both. Take care. Have a good week. Good morning.
WBAI 99.5 FM New York, WBAI.org. It's exactly 10 minutes after 3 o'clock. Thank you very much. Jim Freund, back here next week, same place, same time. Max, feel much better. The show is dedicated to Max Reed, Burn Baby Burn. WBAI 99.5 FM. This show is dedicated to Max Smith. Feel better, Max. 99 Cinco List Alive. The world's only flag burning show where we burn the imperialist red, white, and blue to ashes.
Red, white, and blue, I'm not Captain America, too black, too strong, causing mass hysteria, trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth that's off the way I see it? Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right. Constitution, yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Wake up to the lies the pigs make up. Imperialistic swines that I grind into bacon bits. Call the fist cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison cause I'm busy attacking. Get the flag, I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs dribble when